Welcome to the Modern Yogi Podcast. An exploration of ancient wisdom.
Hello, hello, everyone.
Welcome back to the Modern Yoga Podcast. We're on episode number
122.
We're all laughing because our producer, Abhijit, always draws these cute little like graphs to go along with our episodes. And with
episode
this one,
number, so we know which one it is.
Yeah. And with this one, he drew us three and I'm on crutches and it's, you know, he drew the crutches in. It was funny.
And we never see the picture until right before we start filming, so you got our actual reactions. Also, happy Nityananda Trayodashi.
Nice.
Well, you know what, we're pre-recording this one episode, so when it's released, so for us today it is that. Priya, do you want to say what is that all about?
It's Nityananda's birthday.
Who's Nityananda?
It's Krishna's brother.
Nice.
Well, yeah, Gauranga's brother.
Lord Chaitanya's brother.
Yeah, Lord Chaitanya's brother.
Yeah, but he's like Balaram, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, cool.
It's complex, but basically, Krishna's brother.
Yeah. Krishna's brother, he died. Happy birthday. And it's...
I was just going to say, in Hispanic traditions, I don't know if you experience this, but at least in South America, when it was someone's birthday, they would sing... instead of happy birthday, they would sing Vanchakalpa in the happy birthday tune. So it'd be like Vanchakalpa, Taruvisya, Kirpasindubya Eva Cha, Patitanam, Pavanevyo, Vaishnavevyo, Namo Namaha.
Oh, that's great.
I love that.
It's really cute because you're really just, cute. You know, paying obeisances to the Vaishnavas. So.
That's cute. Very cute.
Yeah.
Well, it's going to be a fun episode today because we are on chapter 16.
Wow. Beginning. We don't have that much left, ladies.
Oh my God. No.
I know.
It's like exciting and sad at the same time.
Closing time. I
know. That was pretty good. So,
thank you. You have a nice voice.
Thank you. Recap on what we learned.
So basically, it's interesting because the 16th chapter is building off of the chapters we're coming off of. So the question is, why does Krishna speak the 16th chapter without being prompted? So in the Bhagavad Gita, there's only one section where Krishna speaks three successive chapters on his own without any prompting questions from Arjuna. So the section of chapters 14, 15, and 16, where we're at now, is where that happens. In the 14th chapter, it contains a question that's answered within that chapter. The 15th chapter, we introduce the whole metaphor of the upside down banyan tree, how to get out of this world. Now, continuing with that tree metaphor from the 16th chapter, Krishna describes two people at two extremes of the tree, the godly and then the ungodly. And we're going to get into all of that. But I thought it was so interesting that this is like the last chapter of three chapters where Krishna just goes on and on and on without any prompting from Arjuna.
It's a monologue.
I've noticed.
It is a monologue.
Oh, yeah.
Because every time we read, I'm like, wait, who's reading? And I'm like, oh, it's still Krishna.
Right.
Oh, okay,
right.
Cool.
Interesting.
Right.
Okay. All right.
So it's interesting because we're going to uncover, basically, I wrote down a one sentence summary of the entire chapter that we're going to get into. Should I do it now or later? Because it kind of sets it up nicely.
Okay.
So basically the one sentence summary is this. After describing the tree of material existence in the 15th chapter, Krishna in the 16th chapter describes these two people that I mentioned at the two extremes of that tree, emphasizing the demonic nature and its consequences to encourage Arjuna.
I love Arjuna.
To encourage Arjuna to do his duty of protecting the world from demonic rulers. So we forgot almost, we're on the battlefield still. And Krishna's really trying to prompt Arjuna of like, these are the people that you need to defeat, these demonic rulers.
So this is the reason, this is part of the reason why you're doing this.
Exactly.
It's an internal thing, but it's also an external thing. As a warrior, you're supposed to protect. Ooh, this
Absolutely.
Is going to be so interesting.
And I think it's good for us to recognize what those demonic qualities are, which Krishna will get into, and then develop more divine qualities for ourselves.
Absolutely.
Ooh, so, can't wait.
Yeah.
All right. Also, we made a little fumble. What the kids call it, a fumble, right? In the last episode, we were talking about the three worlds, and we couldn't really understand. We couldn't really articulate what those were. So I want to pass it over to our producer, our lovely Abhijit, to explain what those three worlds are, because we did a crappy job of explaining that.
Okay, so the three worlds is a concept from Vedic cosmology. It's described in various scriptures, including the Srimad Bhagavatam. So three worlds refers to basically three layers of the material world, all right? So we're not talking about the spiritual world at all. We're just talking about here, down here in the material world.
Oh, that's the opposite of what we said.
Oof. And so the three worlds are the higher planets, the middle planet, and the lower planets, roughly speaking. Okay. And so we are on the middle planet. There's only one middle planet, which is
Bhumi.
Bhuloka. Which is another, you know, the Sanskrit name of Earth. Mm. So the lower planets, there are seven of them, and they are for certain types of residents. And the higher planets, there's six of them, and they are also for certain types of residents, like demigods and demons and so on. So there are 14 planets, and they get divided into these three layers. And so that's the three worlds. If you want to know more about this, where this is coming from, the reference that I can point you to is Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 5, Text 40, Text 39, 40, etc. So you can look towards the end of that chapter. It's all explained there.
So when you say higher planets, you're not talking about the heavenly realm.
We are talking about the heavenly realm, but again, in Vedic conception, there's this distinction between heaven and spiritual world.
Okay, right, right.
So heaven is just a very luxurious material place to be, where you can enjoy material pleasures, but it's also temporary, just like the pleasures of this world and so on. So it's still, this is all material world.
So, right. Yeah. So we are talking about the heavenly realm and the hellish realm within the material realm.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And to give context to what this is about, just in case you're like, wait, what was that reference? What were we talking about? This was text 17 of chapter 15. Mm. And it was just, I'm going to just read the text real quick, just so that we can get a reference back to why we were mentioning this. It said, besides these two, there is the greatest living personality, the supreme soul, the imperishable Lord himself, who has entered the three worlds and is maintaining them. Mm, so he comes into this material world and he is sustaining every single thing. And this was when we were talking about the moon and Krishna giving this energy to the planets and the light and the effulgence. Right. Remember, we were talking about all of those things.
Yeah, so I want to mention that I think in Krishna's mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, you can think of it more as like a colloquial thing. I don't think he's intending to go into the science and cosmology of everything. It's like today we all understand if someone says he moved heaven and earth, we just all know what that means because we know what our modern conception of heaven and earth is. So when Krishna's speaking this 5,000 years ago, he's saying, and then he maintains the three worlds. Everybody at the time knew what that meant. It was just like a known thing.
Just a phrase. It was just like
duh. Just like moving heaven and earth is a phrase we have. So I just want to mention that he's not, I don't think, going into something super deep here, but we were given the background to know where that comes from.
So it's basically the three worlds are the upstairs, the downstairs, and the ground floor, which we level on the ground floor.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
All material.
If you're European, I guess.
True.
Thank you so much.
That was very helpful. Yep. Woo-hoo. All right. The invocation, please, ladies.
Om Jnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha.
Translation. I was born in the darkest ignorance, and my spiritual master opened my eyes with the torch of knowledge. I offer my respectful obeisances unto them.
Oh my God. Right. Chapter 16, guys.
Chapter 16, the divine and demoniac natures.
Oh, goodness. All right. So the first text is actually text 1 through 3.
Mm.
That was a lot for a Hispanic to say.
Through 3.
Thank you. That was challenging. Okay. So the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, fearlessness, purification of one's existence, cultivation of spiritual knowledge, charity, self-control, performance of sacrifice, study of the Vedas, austerity, simplicity, nonviolence, truthfulness, freedom from anger, renunciation, tranquility, aversion to fault-finding, compassion for all living entities, freedom from covetousness,
yeah,
gentleness, modesty, steady determination, vigor, forgiveness, fortitude, cleanliness, and freedom from envy and from the passion for honor. These transcendental qualities, O son of Bharat, belong to godly men endowed with divine nature.
Mm. Wow. That was a laundry list of all of the good qualities that we should be coveting. Correct?
Yes.
Wow.
Definitely.
That's a lot.
That was a lot to process. I don't know if I can remember or, you know, like, how do you even
chunk it up?
Yes.
Ooh, I have a question that can launch us into a good starting place at least. Because once we break the purport, that's a whole lot of pages right there.
Yes.
I heard a class a while ago on this one text that said the whole beginning question was, why is fearlessness the first virtue in the godly nature? And I would love to, I wrote down two parts that that I remember that I would like to bring up, but maybe we can have just a brief talk about this for a moment, because I don't think it's any random order that Krishna spoke this in. And fearlessness is there because it's the first virtue that allows all the others to even be possible. And I thought that was a really cool way to see it, because the class started off just outlining, okay, fear protects us. It can also paralyze us. And basically, life is meant for a purpose bigger than merely just living safely. We need to be ready to sacrifice safety for fulfillment and accepting and even embracing risks sometimes in the pursuit of values and purposes that provide fulfillment. So I thought, okay, nice. That lays the foundation of what fearlessness is. And then in this class, it took a turn, and I really liked this part, and I'd love to hear what thoughts you have. But he said, no godly virtues would even have the space to develop without the presence of fearlessness. Because virtues, they need space inside our consciousness to even become present and then to grow. And there will be always opposition to these virtues, both internally by our own vices and weaknesses, and externally by forces that flourish by exploiting weakness in others. So we're going to have bumps along the road, internal and external, when we're trying to cultivate godly qualities. So virtues can only gain space when we have the courage or the fearlessness not to cower in the face of these vices and weaknesses, both internal and external. And I thought that was a really cool way to see it.
Ooh, so for definitely
everything, we need courage to pursue a higher path and develop godly qualities.
Yeah. My mom, as you say, like every single day, you have two choices. You have either fear or faith. And those two are polar opposites, right? And so that is a choice that we have to make every single day. And the moment we choose faith, then everything that is surrounded, that is, that encompasses fear, goes away, because you're like, okay, Krishna got me. Right? And but there's like hundreds of millions of things to be fearful of, especially nowadays, you know, but it's true. I think that is, once you remove the fear, that's where faith can really take control.
Beautiful. Fear or faith. And you know, I think fear boiled down to its barest is the absence of God, because there we think we're on our own. If I can't control X, Y, and Z, 100%. I'm going to perish. But everything really is beyond our control. So when we know God is there and he's got me, then we can be fearless or choose faith, as you said.
Totally. Yeah. If you, if you look at, I really like what you said, what you both said. And if you look at the other qualifications or the other natures of a divine person, right? After fearlessness, purification of one's existence. In order to even try for purification of one's existences, you have to be courageous, right? Like have faith that there is a process that can actually benefit you, or to do charity. Maybe it's to think, well, I have so little. If I give what I have, maybe I will have none. That would be fear, right?
Right.
Or whatever it might be, right? But like, the fear definitely interferes.
Yeah. Fear interferes for sure.
With developing these other qualities, even just like, you know, nonviolence, truthfulness, freedom from anger, like all of these things. If I don't, if I don't have anger, how will I express my, like, there's so many ways in which we can not develop these qualities because of fear. So,
absolutely.
Like all of it is so intertwined. Like, say for instance, like you're on the road and someone cuts you off, right? That's a fear of losing your life. And that brings about anger.
Yeah.
Right? Everything stems from fear of losing something, right?
So well said.
Yeah. And so it's very, that's the biggest thing we need to cultivate.
Could we give any examples? Because I thought this was so spot on with saying, we'll always confront opposition to developing godly qualities, both internal and external. What could be some examples? Because it was just a very vague description of internally, we have vices and weaknesses, and externally, we have forces that flourish by exploiting weaknesses in others. So one example that popped into my head of externally, you might be surrounded by, let's say, friends at the time that aren't spiritual, and you're trying to pursue a spiritual path, and you have to have the courage and the fearlessness to kind of put your foot down with things that you know, I no longer want to engage in that behavior, and being bold to cultivate your own path. But what could be some examples that we could think of, I don't know, internal challenges and external challenges that you need to be fearless or courageous to cultivate? And I think maybe it's hard to think right off the bat, but I'm sure we all have gone through our own things where we have to be bold in the face of even our own weaknesses, mm-hmm. to be like, look, I'm not going to let the darkness overtake me, and focus on the qualities that we are trying to pursue rather than give in to, yeah, internal weaknesses. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of societal pressures to be a certain way.
Right.
There's a lot of sometimes parental pressures to be a certain way, right? If you guys have opposing views on certain things, I think even like with friends and whatnot, I think you're right to choose the right thing when you're, you know, this is from personal experience, when you're 22 and you're trying to make friends and you want to fit in, and you know,
totally.
And so there's a lot of that. I think a lot of societal pressures for me that I had to navigate.
Right. Mm. Or even Priya, you brought up a story the last episode of some friend who chose to eat meat because, oh, an opportunity arose. Maybe there was a social group involved. I don't know. But it's kind of like fearlessness to not give in to your own vices and to the external pressures.
Yeah, I think vices can be like, they're not just the typical like, oh, I'm like trying to think of something non-cliche, but it's like, oh, you know, like, I smoke or I gamble or this. It's not just the simplicity of that, but vices could also be like, oh, I don't really give myself the opportunity to wake up early, or I'm not phrasing it correctly, but even just like vices of like, we're stuck in routines that are not good for us. In that sense of vices, things that are not helping in our spiritual progress, and fear of, well, if I commit to doing better, then I have to do better all the time. And then I might not be good enough to even continue to do it, right?
So I might as well not even try.
So I might as well just kind of continue doing what I'm doing and not even try.
I love that example. It's more nuanced, and it's a fearlessness to overcome our own self-doubt.
Yeah, like something that's happening internally, right? And it doesn't, that's why I wanted to explain the idea of vices that are not these super stereotypical ones.
Right.
Like a lot of people struggle with different kinds of mental challenges that are just, a lot of us share about just what is better, to chant my japa imperfectly or to not chant my japa today.
Yeah.
Like even that question, right? And the mental speculation that, you know, goes into like, what, the fear of doing the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know I'm sure there's more examples, but.
So yeah, I think fearlessness sets us off super well for all of the laundry list of very godly qualities.
Yep. Well, Prabhupada actually, he tells us a lot about where fearlessness comes from or comes into play in this society. But before he does that, he says, for those acting in the modes of goodness are considered to have auspicious progress on the path of liberation.
Mm.
So I think the reason I'm saying this is because he's saying like, well, in order to be this kind of person that has all these qualities, you have to be acting and doing activities in the mode of goodness, right? Because for those that are in the modes of passion and ignorance, there is no possibility of liberation. These qualities will be much harder to achieve. Like that's kind of the premise. So he's kind of stating that.
Right.
And then he starts talking about the Varnashram Dharma.
The who now?
The who? So we've talked about this a little bit before, and we're not going to go too much into depth, but basically it's the four divisions of spiritual life and four occupational divisions. So basically it's based on educational qualifications. And this is a system to keep society in a state of peace and prosperity. Now there's the four divisions are the sannyasis, give me 1 second. I just want to make sure.
Wait. While you find
I got it.
This is essentially like the four phases of life, right?
Yes.
Okay. Got it.
All right. Like the four. Yeah. Exactly. So basically, you have the sannyasis. You have the kshatriyas. So sannyasis are the priests, the celibate leaders, the spiritual leaders of society.
And these are the older people?
Sometimes, but yeah, because I think Lord Chaitanya wasn't that old when he did it.
Never mind.
But yes, usually that is, that's the case.
When you give up everything and you...
That would be after you give up... Go ahead. No, you're good. I'm sort of just explaining it from this perspective rather than the full life perspective, but it's okay.
Question, are we talking about the occupational divisions like Kshatriya, Sudra, all that, or are we talking about the divisions of life like Brahmachari?
Right. Yes. We're talking about the divisions in terms of occupation.
Okay. So phases of life, Shama would refer to the other one, but I got confused for a minute because they can both...
They intertwine in some ways, but thank you for that clarification. It's very important. So we're talking more so about jobs in society. Yes. Okay. So these four jobs in society. So we have the brahmanas who are the spiritual leaders. Mm. They are the priests. They are celibate. They're like these positions. Then we have the kshatriyas who are the warriors, right?
Like Arjuna.
Then we have the vaishyas who are the merchants. Like they're the salesperson, business, all of that. Mm-hmm. And then we have the shudras who are more of the laborers, workers, right? And so again, we're not actually going into depth into all of them, but we're actually specifically talking about sannyasis,
right?
Which are the brahmanas, right?
And one interjection that this isn't meant to divide human society according to birth. These divisions are in terms of what is your natural tendency, your propensity, and your educational qualification.
Yeah.
But sometimes you are born into a certain class, no? Yeah. Like if you're born into a business person's family.
And you're cultivated to be a businessman. Right. And
And there's kids who like, now that I've have so many toddlers and little babies in my life, nephews and So I've seen like some of them have innate qualities.
Right.
Like some of them are like more clean. They must take a shower after anything. They must wash their hands after touching anything dirty, as even if it's consecutively.
Yeah.
Whereas other kids are like, I don't care about dirt, and they'll put it everywhere. And and they're more like, you know, so every like you have some innate qualities that you're kind of
natural
coming
leaders
with.
Leaders or peacemakers.
Exactly. So anyways, so Prabhupada goes on to say that in this Varnashram institution, the sannyasi is considered to be the head of all the social statuses. So not a brahmana, but a sannyasi specifically. Okay. And then a sannyasi is someone who is considered to be the spiritual master of even the brahmanas also. So even though the brahmana generally is considered to be the spiritual master of the kshatriyas and the vaishyas and the shudras, the sannyasi is the like spiritual leader for everyone, including the brahmanas.
What's a brahmana for someone who doesn't know what that means?
A priest.
Okay, got it.
But also not necessarily. I feel like brahmana's qualities are someone who is, you know, they're the... One second, let me think about this. The Ravenclaws of the world, of the Harry Potter worlds. Like
oh boy. Okay.
I know it's not your world.
But tell me, what are the Ravenclaws for someone who doesn't know?
Yeah, it's about like people who are very... studious wisdom, knowledge, very much about cultivating and spreading knowledge.
Right.
That's their
Ravenclaws.
So that's what,
got it.
That's what brahmanas are, right? And so the sannyasis are overall the spiritual guides of everyone.
They're also the gurus, right?
Yeah, the sannyasis are the gurus.
Okay, perfect.
But usually in society, brahmanas are the guides of the kshatriyas, vaishyas, and shudras. Mm. So like we in ISKCON, we have like second initiated devotees that would be brahmanas.
Mm.
Also, that's like another way of saying it in our society.
Okay.
And they're supposed to be examples for the rest of us.
They're like really, really good devotees.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Okay. Anyways, so a sannyasi is the first qualification for a sannyasi is that they should be fearless.
Mm.
And that's where fearless comes from, or at least this is Prabhupada's explanation for it, because he has simply to depend on the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Mm.
If such a person thinks, after I leave my connections, who will protect me? That person should not accept the renounced order of life.
Wow.
Because you have to fully rely on Krishna or God because you're like, I don't know where my next meal is going to come from. I'm going to like literally give my life to you and spread your name. But like literally if you're thinking like, oh my God, who's going to take care of me? Nope. You're not.
Right. Exactly.
And think of what Prabhupada did. His life is an example of that, to come at such an old age from India to a totally foreign land on a boat.
So much faith.
And he wrote the whole famous poem, Let me dance, make me dance, you know, just Krishna take the reins.
That's a lot of fearlessness.
It's amazing. So then Prabhupada goes on to say that one must be fully convinced that Krishna is always within. If for a sannyasi specifically, he has to be convinced that Krishna is always within our heart as Paramatma, and he is seeing everything, and he always knows what one intends to do. So having that clear understanding is another, you know, that is a qualification that you have to understand that in order to be a sannyasi.
Right.
And then Prabhupada also goes on to say that a sannyasi has this mood of, even if I live in the darkest of regions of a forest, I shall be accompanied by Krishna, and he will give me all the protection.
Ooh,
beautiful.
Wow.
So it's very sweet perception of what a sannyasi is supposed to be. And then it goes on to talk about, and you know, this is just like a interesting to know, just knowledge, but it goes to talk about what the rules and regulations that sannyasis have to also follow. And one reason I think this is important to talk about is because oftentimes Krishna consciousness, as many as other religions, can be considered, or maybe joked, I don't know what the right term to say is, but they could be said, oh, this is a cult, right? Mm. And something important to know is that sannyasis are meant to be the leaders of our society. They're supposed to be the guidance. And here Prabhupada makes a very important distinction, which is actually what makes our movement so pure. Or we try, you know, we try to keep
trying our best.
I know it's not always been because, you know, humans. But a sannyasi is forbidden to talk to a woman in a secluded place. They are also forbidden to have any intimate relationship with a woman. And this is not a sign of hatred for a woman. It is more of a protection. Mm. And it is also more for the sannyasi to keep their vows and their, you know.
Right. To live a very pure position. Life.
Yeah. So I find that to be, the reason I said it like that is because you see sometimes some of these other documentaries about actual cults, and it's a lot of taking advantage of women. Mm-hmm. And
I
actually like that rule, actually. Like, I don't want to be in a room with a male doctor by myself, you know, like, but that's my own stuff.
That might be
through.
A personal
thing. Yeah, but you know what I mean? But, I just think that it's important. I think that it's a good rule to protect women.
Yeah, but I think also, yeah, Priya, that's such a good example that so many, let's say, fake leaders in different spiritual movements who have fallen down, they just totally give in to the temptations of their fame, wealth, and all the women that are flocking around them. Right. But if you look at someone like Srila Prabhupada, who brought this whole movement to the West, he was so pure. You could never catch him in a moment where you'd be like, ah, okay, there's your true nature. Right. No, he was the same behind closed doors than he was to millions of people. He was just so pure.
He was like a father to everyone, respectful to everyone, encouraging to everyone. He encouraged so many women to take roles that were not previously occupied by them in Indian society and all these things, you know? So,
but now that we have allowed females to be sannyasis, does that mean a female sannyasi cannot be in a room alone with a man?
Mm-hmm. But I mean,
equality, we won.
Definitely. I mean, I've lived that rule many times before because I've served many different sannyasis in the past. And all it means is that you just never go alone. You take one or two people with you whenever you are in that situation. So,
That should be for all situations.
Just respectful. Yeah, because just mindful.
You know, it's not like it'll automatically mean because they're around a woman, they'll do something. But if you just think human nature, there's something very subtle that transpires even between, like, I think we can all acknowledge that if you're friendships with people of like someone who you're not, a gender who you're not attracted to, that's different than friendships with a gender who you are attracted to. It's innately different. And there's something super subtle. We're inclusive on this podcast.
You
know,
you're very inclusive. You said that very perfectly. It was great.
It was. Well done. Well done.
Are we just on fearlessness, guys? Yep. Are we on the first quality that Krishna talks about?
But I'm done with fearlessness. What is next?
Hi-oh. Purification of one's existence.
I'm scrolling down. I'm looking.
Scrolling?
Scrolling down our
physical Bhagavad Gita. We're doing this podcast Gita. On our phones? No, I'm joking.
We're not.
The next item, is that where it starts? Jnana Yoga? The one being engaged in the cultivation of knowledge, right? Isn't that where we're picking up?
It seems like it goes on to sannyasi a little bit more.
A little bit more.
I feel like, you know, we've covered the idea that sannyasis are sort of the example of
the purification of one's existence.
The fearlessness.
Never mind. I was trying to do two birds, one stone.
Lord Chaitanya gave a beautiful, for Lord Chaitanya, he said, for a sannyasi or anyone who is aspiring to get out of the clutches of material nature and trying to elevate himself to the spiritual nature and go back home, back to Godhead, for him, looking toward material possessions and women for sense gratification, not even enjoying them, but to look at them with such a propensity is just... It's
condemned.
Condemned. Yes.
And but we should also be developing these qualities, right? Sorry.
Yes.
We just had a moment. It's fine. Yeah.
We should also be developing these qualities, even if we're probably not going to be sannyasis one day.
Oh, yeah.
No, yeah. I think what Prabhupada was saying is this is what fearlessness looks like in this position. Mm-hmm. And this is something we can aspire to learn over time.
Exactly. Because, yeah, fearlessness will come into play differently for all of us. Like for a householder, we're probably never going to aspire to the status of a sannyasi just in our role in life. But for a householder, fearlessness can come into play in so many other ways.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. And after that portion, the next item that they bring up is, Priya, do you want to read the Sanskrit or Shama?
Vyavashtiti.
Vyavashtiti is the one I wasn't sure about. Basically, being engaged in the cultivation of knowledge. So as Priya mentioned, sannyasi life is basically meant for distributing knowledge to householders and others who have forgotten their real life of spiritual advancement. So it's interesting because Srila Prabhupada writes this in a way that can be very applicable to modern day society, that he says a sannyasi is supposed to, in a way, beg from door to door for his livelihood, but that does not mean that he is a beggar. So before rolling, I said, you know, that almost sounds a little outdated. And we had a brief talk about how, no, begging, quote unquote, from door to door doesn't mean necessarily like alms for the poor. Like it just means that you are traveling around spreading spiritual knowledge and you're dependent on, how did Abhijit say?
He said it so well. It was like you are dependent on other people's mercy.
Right. Yeah, because they're basically sponsored to go from this temple to that household to this program.
To continue to preach.
To continue preaching, exactly. So living the life of a sannyasi, on one hand, you might think that is so cool. You always get to travel. But they apply a lot of qualities of total detachment from to not have a routine. I think if any of us have traveled, you get back home and you're like, home sweet home.
Home sweet home. I love my home.
I love my home so much.
There's nothing like getting tongue twisted when you're rolling on air, right?
So fun. I love when one of us does it, the other ones just jump on, we pounce on it so fast.
I know. But yeah, so there's something totally detached and they surrender any personal luxury, any space that's their own, and they're totally just dependent on, okay, Krishna, where are you going to take me next?
They don't have a job or other means of income
exactly.
Other than the mercy of Krishna through his devotees.
And in a way it makes so much sense because when people have a job, your whole time goes towards, okay, I work, I'm maintaining my family. And that role, it's important. Not everyone can be sannyasis, but then the sannyasis are the people who spread the knowledge. Mm. And that is their job. That's what they're doing. That's their role in life.
Yeah. And not everyone can be a sannyasi.
Not everyone can be a sannyasi.
Not everyone can be a grihasta either. Like, totally. You know, there's people who are like, I don't need material possessions. I want to preach. I want to do this. And they're amazing at it. So, got to find your roles.
With what you just said, Priya, it reminded me, Radhana Swami was giving a talk at a university. And I don't remember exactly word for word, but the gist of it was, he was giving a speech on renunciate life. And I think maybe he was talking about sannyasis. And this one student gets up and is almost like very arrogantly challenging. And he's like, but don't we need the doctors and the lawyers? And what would happen if we can't all be sannyasis? And I think Radhana Swami joked that in that moment he prayed, okay, Krishna, inspire me with what to say. And his answer was very like concise and boom. But the point was, yeah, you need sannyasis also, and you need doctors and lawyers. Everyone has a role and a function in society. Mm-hmm. You can't all be playing the same role, or the world wouldn't function that way.
Yeah.
And Prabhupada goes on to say that humility is such an important quality for a sannyasi because out of sheer humility, they're also depending so much on not only the Lord, but on the people who are going to help continue their preaching efforts, you know? So, you know, in a way, relying on your own self, it's convenient and to have to go to ask for, I don't know, help or to be sponsored to go to a certain place, that does take a little bit of like, I don't own anything myself for me. That is a humble role.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that's such an important quality for us to try to foster within ourselves too. I think that's one of the hardest.
Yeah. So then Prabhupada says a nice little sentence to summarize. Basically, a sannyasi, or one in the renounced order of life, must be A, situated in fearlessness, B, have purity, and C, knowledge or jnana yoga. So those three are qualities that a sannyasi might have or needs to have.
That's super sweet.
Yeah. And then he begins talking about charity. Now, charity is meant for householders because you know how we talked about the different, you know, this is a good moment to bring up briefly. I know, Priya, you brought up the Varnashram Dharma in regards to the different roles, but there's also the different stages of life, as Shama said, right? So, because they're about to talk about charity for the householder. So I want to kind of just, let's maybe take a sentence to just say the different phases of life. It might be like first you're a student or a brahmachari, then you become a grihastha, householder, then, so there's different phases, then the phase where you're preparing for, you know, for the end, for death, and you renounce things and just dedicate more to spiritual cultivation of knowledge. So a sannyasi who's already at the mercy of just people and their preaching mission, they can't really give so much in charity because they don't own that much. So that's why when you're a householder, you should try to give to, Prabhupada says, a householder should try to give charity to institutional societies that are engaged in this way of cultivating spiritual knowledge, you know? So there's different like institutions that are in the mode of goodness, passion, and ignorance. And a society that spreads spirituality, and in our case, Krishna consciousness, that is a charity of the mode of goodness. So you want to then help these charities that spread spirituality and basically give back in any way you can if you're a householder.
Yeah, I think it's also the position of those who are a householder, meaning in, you know, have a partner and children and have an everyday job, these kinds of people, because they may not have the time or opportunity or just, you know, whatever, to go out and devote themselves to preaching or sharing this knowledge, then what they can do is say, oh, the sannyasi is doing such a great job spreading it. Let me support them so that they can continue in this endeavor and everyone can benefit, right?
That's a good way to say it. Yeah, it's kind of like the sliding scale of if you can't do this, do this. If you can't do this, then like you say, promote someone who is doing that.
Right. Yeah.
I like that. I feel like that's a little loophole that we can all benefit from.
For sure.
Well, the next part, this is just a very fun list of qualities and qualifications. The next is dhamma, self-control. And it's not only meant for certain orders or religious societies, but especially for a householder. Because in the householder section, you do have a wife, a husband, whatever. And basically it's saying, that's a very slippery slope to totally indulge your senses if, like, you know, if you're very in love, or I guess even if you're not, but you can totally indulge in sensual pleasure life. And it's basically saying, don't go totally unhinged. You know, you should have certain restrictions because we can't forget what is the main goal. And the main goal is to elevate our consciousness and to get out of this hole to this world.
Nice.
So yeah. So in householder life, it's just basically like, yeah, there's certain restrictions, how to engage in things in more the mode of goodness. And we always have to remember it is a sliding scale. So this philosophy promotes the topmost, like the most pure thing is to always think of Krishna, and everything has to do with Krishna. But then you can take stock or inventory of where am I and what can I do to elevate it? You know? So if a householder wants to make progress in spiritual life, he must control his sex life. And to different people, that might mean something different. We have to be very real with where we're at and what can we do. I think that's good.
That is all you want to say to that. I think when it comes to self-control, there was something I wanted to say, it was in the tip of my tongue, but I'm not grasping it.
Well, while you think of it, I'll say one sentence that Prabhupada said that's nice.
Okay.
He said, if one is able to beget children who will be in Krishna consciousness, one can produce hundreds of children. But without this capacity, one should not indulge only for sense pleasure. So it's basically about, we talk about not overindulging in sense pleasure, right? So, you know, there's certain ways to act in more mode of goodness ways of life, you know?
I remember what I was going to say. It's something I read in a different document where it was talking about the four regulative principles, right? Which one of them is no illicit sex. And it was saying like, it is an addiction. Right. It can be an intoxicant or addiction if you allow it to be just like
anything else, gambling,
anything else, coffee, whatever it might be, right? Mm-hmm. So that's another way of perceiving it, right? Too much of anything is just bad.
Yeah. That's a great point, Priya, because actually I've heard about that before and I've had it explained in different ways. Like sex life in and of itself is not inherently bad. It's not like we're marchers that shame ourselves of this is a bad thing, but it's like a kid entering a candy store that it has the capacity to be totally all encompassing and consuming if you allow it to be.
Yeah.
That's
the
thing.
And Krishna also says he is sex life, right? Yeah. So it's sex life is not inherently bad.
Absolutely.
I think it's like that whole scalpel situation, right? Like a knife in the hand of a surgeon can be good and a knife in the hand of a murderer can be bad. It's depending on how you use it.
We didn't know where you were going with that, and we both got scared. Say it one more time.
Wait, so like a knife in the hand of a surgeon can be a good thing. Right. A knife in the hand of a murderer can be a bad thing.
I think
it's like the context of how you use it is very important.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, actually, right at the beginning of the purport, something that was brought up earlier was Krishna says, and I think this is just like the highest standard, right? I think that's also really good to know. But Prabhupada says in the Bhagavad Gita, we have studied also that sex life for begetting a good child is Krishna himself.
Mm.
Right? So there's like just, it's not so black and white.
Right.
And it's just about
balance.
Self-control.
Self-control.
Nice.
There we go.
And everything in moderation.
Nailed it. We are the modern yogis and we're moving on to the next quality we're trying to talk about. So sacrifice. Sacrifice is another one that should be performed by householders because, as we said, different orders of life, like brahmacharis, when you're a young student, you don't have that many possessions to your name to sacrifice. When you're a sannyasi, so if you are a householder and you have some way of giving back, of sacrificing part of your income to help sponsor and promote other people who are able to spread spiritual knowledge, go for it. And Prabhupada says the best sacrifice recommended in this age is Sankirtan Yagya. Yagya?
Yagya.
You said it right.
Okay.
You got
I always doubt myself.
Yagya, anyway, it's spelt weird. So it's always just like, is it like Yagya? What is it? You know? So it's confusing. Yeah, it's confusing.
The chanting of the holy name, it's the best and most inexpensive sacrifice. It's Hare Krishna,
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
And then, you know, it's so funny because this is such a long purport that, you know, beforehand we chunk it into, okay, you take these pages, I'll take these. My page is still going on. It's fun. So
that's why Shelley's talking for this long.
It's not by choice. It's just my page and it's very dense.
Wait, before you move on from sacrifice, I have a question. So it made it seem like the sacrifice was only kind of for householders and that the only sacrifice was to donate money. But that would, in my mind, fall under the category of charity. Is there any other sacrifices that you guys can think of? Obviously, Prabhupada says the biggest and greatest sacrifice is to, you know, the chanting of the Sankirtan Yagya and to chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. But like, can you think of other things that also encompass?
The first one that popped into my head is, let's say you just had children and you feel like, oh man, I can't do that many sacrifices. I'm just barely raising my children. That is your sacrifice as a mother or as a father. You're trying to raise Krishna conscious children. And I remember my mom, she used to be one of the top book distributors. The year that she was pregnant with me, she was number two in the world.
And then
it was like she was unstoppable. And after she had children, especially after my younger sister was born, she just dedicated to being a mother. And whenever her spiritual master, Tamal Krishna Goswami, would come into town, she almost felt a little self-conscious of like, I'm not doing so much now. And she would almost like, if she saw him chanting outside, she would almost hide, like, don't look at me. And then she ended up writing a letter to him about her feelings. And he responded so beautifully, saying essentially, now your duty is as a mother and you're raising Krishna conscious children. Mm-hmm. And that is a form you sacrifice your own time, well-being, self-care, whatever, to raise these children so they can be leaders of society and promote spirituality and whatever role they'll do.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think 100%. I know everyone in this room doing this podcast is not a parent, but kudos to parents out there that is a huge sacrifice.
It's one of the greatest sacrifices, even in Krishna consciousness, actually. Mm-hmm. Because you are bringing into the world just another person who has all this knowledge and understanding and like the characteristics of a good, as we were talking, divine natures.
Yeah. And especially as Kali Yuga gets worse and worse, trying to raise children that are in the mode of goodness will get harder and harder and harder.
Yeah.
And so kudos.
Definitely a sacrifice. That was a great one.
Yeah. And to summarize, it just says these three items, charity, sense control, and performance of sacrifice, are meant for householders. So if you're a householder, just try to keep those three in mind. So,
amazing.
Yeah. I think this is a very, very long purport. And I think we finished maybe one or two verses.
I know. Say two.
Yeah. I think let's say two. Yeah. But that's all the time we have for this episode. So we are going to continue on with chapter 16, text number three.
Exactly.
And it's going to be a good dang time.
It's going to be a good old time.
Yeah.
Can't wait to see you guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Hello, beautiful souls. If you like what you're hearing, please follow us on Instagram at Modern Yogi Podcast.
And if you love what you're hearing, please make sure to share a link to our podcast at Modern Yogi Podcast with all your friends, families, and long-lost cousins.
And if you have any questions at all, send us a DM on Instagram at Modern Yogi Podcast, and we'll be sure to get back to you.
Thank you for listening to
The Modern Yogi.